From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The Glasgow Climate Conference is winding up. Scott Morrison is out in the electorate campaigning on his net zero climate policy, with mixed success. Attention is now turning to Labor, which will release its own policy within weeks. In 2019, the Morrison government had Bill Shorten on the back foot over climate, zeroing in on his policy's lack of costings and mixed messages delivered to the coal areas and the leafy suburbs. Anthony Albanese is determined not to get caught as Shorten was. His general approach to next year's election is to be a small target. But how small can he go on climate and still keep faith with Labor's supporters and many others in the community who rank it as an important issue? Today we talk to Chris Bowen, Labor's climate spokesman. Chris Bowen, as the Glasgow Climate Conference begins to wrap up, what do you see as the messages coming out of that conference so far?
Look, I think, Michelle, it has been a step forward, but not enough. And that is the real message for the world and for Australia. I mean, it's good that if all the commitments people have made inside and outside COP are met, then they will hold the world to just under 2 degrees of warming. But that's not good enough. What we agreed to do in Paris collectively and reconfirmed at the G20 was to hold the world as close as possible to 1.5 degrees of warming. And that's hard, but it's absolutely essential. The difference in living standards for future generations between 1.5 and 2 is just enormous. And so much more needs to be done. So a step forward at COP. It's not, you know, it's not Copenhagen. It's not as disastrous as Copenhagen, but nor is it Paris, where, you know, the world could breathe a sigh of relief. It's somewhere in between and not good enough.
So ambitions need to be upped fairly soon by countries, including Australia.
Especially Australia. I mean, that group of countries that went to Glasgow with no increase in our NDCs in the medium term is a pretty small club and not one that we should be in, but we are in it. And, you know, Australia's important for a couple of reasons. You know, deniers and delayers say, oh, but we're just 1% of global emissions, which is not really the point. You know, we're the 14th biggest emitter in the world, and there's 176 countries that emit less than us. So that argument really says, well, those 13 who are bigger than us and emit more than us, they've got to do everything, and us and the 177 others, we don't have to do anything. And that 177 countries is around a third of world emissions. So that's important. And also, we're Australia. We punch above our weight. We like to be an influential country, and we have never been as out of touch on any issue ever in our foreign affairs than we are on climate change. So I think there's a particular onus on Australia.
So during COP26, more than 40 countries agreed to phase out their use of coal-fired power, but Australia did not sign up to that. Should it have done so?
No, we haven't called on the government to do that. We believe that coal-fired power will be determined by a couple of things. The lifespan of the existing coal-fired power stations and the market. And I've been very clear, there'll be no new coal-fired power stations under an Albanese Labor government because we won't provide government funding for them, which is what is really necessary for any of them to work because the private sector won't touch them. Nobody credible in the private sector would touch a new coal-fired power station. So the difference between us and the government is not that we would close existing coal-fired power stations earlier. The difference between us and the government is that we wouldn't replace coal-fired power stations which do close with new coal-fired power stations. Now, they promise one for Collinsville, for example. Now, they don't promise that in Melbourne. They don't talk about that in Melbourne or Sydney, but they do talk about it in North Queensland. That's the official approach of the government, that they're going down the road of having a new coal-fired power station at Collinsville. That's the difference between us and them.
Well, not exactly, because they now say that study won't be finished until after the election. A very long study, it was promised.
Oh, isn't that convenient, Michelle? Isn't that convenient? I bet that's not what they're saying at Collinsville, where, you know, they're running around saying coal's got a great future, we'll have a new coal-fired power station in North Queensland. I mean, they've been caught saying different things in different parts of Australia. I am unambiguous. There's no need for a feasibility study for a new coal-fired power station in Collinsville because it doesn't stack up. I'm unambiguous.
It might disappear after the election, though.
Well, I mean, why don't they just come out and tell the truth?
Now, Matt Keane, who's the Liberal New South Wales Environment Minister, said this week that Australia has some of the worst fuel standards anywhere in the world. Worse, he said, than China and India. Do you believe that addressing these standards should be among the top priorities of the federal government?
Well, I certainly think there's more to be done on electric vehicles. That's what really Matt is talking about there. That is the sort of view that the industry puts in the FCAI, the automobile manufacturers, the motorists put in the AAA, the automobile associations, that there's no framework to encourage car makers to send their lower emission vehicles to Australia, so we're a dumping ground. Now, I think that's a legitimate conversation to be had. And I, you know, Matt, what Matt has said there, Matt Keane has said there, is a statement of fact. Now, we're still looking at our broader electric vehicles policy. We've already announced our electric vehicles tax cut to reduce the price. What role other mechanisms might play is still something that we work through in consultation with industry. But this government has singularly failed at every turn to do anything about electric vehicle policy in Australia. Hence, we are a dumping ground for more expensive, higher emissions vehicles, and Australians pay the price economically and environmentally for that.
So you did announce earlier this year a fairly detailed electric vehicles policy, but you're saying that that will be enhanced when you put out your climate policy.
Well, we made it clear when we did that that was one element of our electric vehicles policy. It wasn't the be-all and end-all. It's our, if you like, our cost offering. It's our policy to reduce the cost of electric vehicles by cutting the taxes on them. Now, cost is important, but it's not the only thing when it comes to EV policy. There's things around, you know, what we call range anxiety. Range anxiety is still real, despite the fact that there's many, many more charging stations now throughout the country. We have said that we would have an electric vehicle strategy when we're in office.
Labor's been talking about the jobs that will be generated through a change to renewable energy, but your critics point out that renewable energy enterprises often are less labor-intensive than the old fossil fuel industries. What do you say to this point?
Well, that's one of the myths that climate change deniers like to perpetrate. And it's not true when you take the entire cycle of renewable energy. Now, they point to solar farms and say not many people work at solar farms. Well, of course, not many people work at solar farms, but that's just one small sliver. When you take renewable energy as a whole and energy efficiency, every dollar spent on renewable energy and energy efficiency creates three times more jobs than a dollar spent on traditional energy. And that's also true when you consider some of the other things the country has to do. That we also have to upgrade our transmission massively to get renewable energy from where it's generated to where it's consumed. Our electricity grid can't cope. So we need billions of dollars of investment to upgrade our transmission grid. We have a policy to deal with that. But that'll create lots of jobs. When you think about that massive task of laying new transmission grid wires across the country, a lot of jobs, a lot of steel involved, as much as possible made in Australia, etc. And then you've got storage. You know, storage is the unplaced piece of the puzzle in Australia. Renewable energy, we know what to do, and the markets, you know, as best they can, getting on with it. But storage has a long, long way to go. We're going to need batteries. We're going to need pumped hydro. We're going to need hydrogen. There's a lot of jobs to be created there. So the story is a good one for job creation and renewable and a renewable economy. That's before we even get to renewable energy manufacturing. You know, making more solar panels in Australia, making more of the components of wind turbines in Australia, making more of the components of batteries in Australia, entire batteries in Australia, and manufacturing more broadly, reducing the cost of energy to put manufacturing in a more competitive space. So there's a very good job story to tell, and it's a job story in the regions. You know, most of this stuff will happen in the regions, not in the cities. Apart from solar panels on our roofs, we don't have space for big renewable energy installations in the cities. we do in the regions.
We know the transition to a clean economy is absolutely necessary, and we know it will produce great opportunities, but there will be transition costs and some people will be losers. The people getting the new jobs won't necessarily be the same people as those losing the old ones. Will there have to be a big transition package or packages for the losers like we've had when there's been structural adjustments in particular industries?
I don't see it in terms of a transition as such. I see it in terms of transformation of the entire economy. That's maybe a subtle difference, but an important one. And I think that the difference is that it's a positive way of viewing it. So we want to create jobs in the regions through, a framework of investment to encourage renewable energy installations and storage and transmission. The market will determine the future of coal and gas-fired power, but it's going to see big changes. It's going to see big changes for coal exports as well, which we might touch on. And so that is going to require changes in the economy. But I see it as a positive story to say we're going to diversify regional economies, create new jobs, have lots of regional job creation as we go. And that's a positive story for Australia's regions.
You mentioned coal. What point are you making here about future coal exports?
70% of our trading partners, probably more now, are committed to net zero by mid-century. That is going to impact on our coal exports. That's going to impact on coal communities. We have to be honest about that. The National Party in particular loves to wander around and say, coal's going to keep going forever. Well, coal will be an important part of our export mix for years to come, but it is dishonest to pretend that coal communities aren't going to be impacted by reducing coal exports as countries move away from coal-fired power.
So what is your message to those communities?
That we are with them every step of the way, that we are going to create new jobs, we're going to create jobs opportunities for them and for their kids, and that they'll have choices about how they handle that change and where they choose to work. We want to give them those choices. We know that, so people in coal communities are used to change. I mean, coal prices go up and down, but we know that that international economic trends impact on communities. I've said before, Michelle, I've told the story of my family that came to Australia in 1880. They were coal miners from Wales, and they went to mine in Mount Morgan, which was at the time the biggest mine in the world. It's in North Queensland. It was a thriving place, Mount Morgan. You go there now, the mine closed in 1980. It's still a lovely place, but nobody would pretend there's huge economic opportunities for young people. The community wasn't assisted through with diversification, etc. We don't have to make those mistakes for coal communities now.
But they'll want you to be specific about how they'll be helped when these changes take place, rather than just saying we're with you.
Yeah, and that's right. We're with you is the broad message, but we're also going to have detailed plans for communities. We're also going to have an opportunity for them to have a say from the ground up in their economic future, etc. So that's right. But it's just the first point is making the point that the world is changing, and that's going to impact.
So when your policy comes out, you will be specific in terms of fleshing out that message?
Oh, we'll have a very detailed policy across the board, and we'll also have quite a degree of analysis of our policy and what it means for the Australian economy as well.
Now, I realise you won't be specific about that policy, but you can confirm, I presume, that it will come out around early December, certainly before Christmas.
We've made clear that it'll be out in very good time. I'm not going to announce the timing on your show this morning. We have said that COP needs to run its course, and also as we're recording this podcast, the government hasn't even released the modelling of their policy, which is an important input to consider. You don't release an alternative budget or a budget reply until you've seen the budget. And we're still seeing them drip feed out their climate change policies. We've had a couple in the last couple of days. They said 2 weeks ago there wouldn't be any more policies. Now we're getting new policies announced daily. So the baseline keeps changing. But I'm sure our listeners should be under no illusions. There'll be a very detailed policy offering out in very good time from Labor.
Can you indicate, given that Labor's approach is a small target one generally, whether this will be small target or whether it will be somewhat ambitious? And specifically, we talked at the beginning about Australia upping its targets or needing to in the short term, i.e. next year or whatever. Can you indicate whether Labor would go down that track?
So I don't... People talk about small target, big target, and, you know, commentators can make that. I talk about sort of a reasonable policy approach. We've already announced, I'll make a few points, Michelle. We've already announced quite a bit of climate change policy. You know, so I don't want anybody listening to be under the illusions that we are waiting to announce climate change policy. We've already announced quite a lot, you know, whether it be the Rewiring the Nation policy, the $20 billion grid upgrade. I know that's not going to, you know, grab the front page, but it's vitally important. Our electric vehicle tax cut we've talked about, our community batteries policy, very important for storage, our new energy apprentices to make sure we have skills to make the most of this massive revolution in our economy. So we've been very active, but I also have been very clear we've got a lot more to do and a lot more to announce. And we will be ambitious. We will be ambitious. I will be realistic, you know, when I'm framing a policy proposal for my shadow cabinet colleagues, one of the most important things I have in mind is it implementable in government? You know, is it credible in government? Because I hope it intend to be the climate change minister, you know, within 6 months. So anything we say, it's got to be, you know, it's got to be realistic, but it will be realistic and ambitious. Both of these things can be true. So...
A fine line between those two things, realism and ambition.
Sure, but yeah, sure. And look, you know, I can guarantee you this. The Liberals and Nationals will come out and say it's far too ambitious and, you know, it'll wreck the economy. And the Greens will come out and say it's a sellout. You know, that's what happens when you're the sensible party in these conversations.
You nearly said sensible centre.
Well, but I didn't. I said sensible party in these conversations. You know, we will be ambitious. We are ambitious, but it'll also be practical and implementable.
Now, the government is planning to link $500 million for a new technology fund to the Senate agreeing to the Clean Energy Finance Corporation being allowed to invest in carbon capture and storage, which Labor has opposed this organisation being able to invest there. The Prime Minister wants to wedge Labor here. Will you let him?
Well, he's wedged himself, Michelle. I mean, this morning... Two coalition senators have come out and said they're crossing the floor to vote against it. I mean, he thought he was terribly clever setting up this alleged wedge of Labor, and he's wedged himself. And this is symptomatic of the broader dysfunction and division in the coalition. I mean, the last time they tried to change the CEFC mandate, they had to withdraw the bill. Well, I mean, it's still technically on the books, but we've never seen it. Because Barnaby Joyce, of all people, when he was a backbencher, moved amendments to put coal into the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. And then that's in the Senate, moved amendments to put nuclear into the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. So don't worry about wedging us. They've wedged themselves. Now, in relation to our position, we have opposed consistently taking money from CFC and ARENA and re-diverting that towards other things. Now, if this is genuinely new money, as the government claims it is, I mean, I'll explore that. I'll interrogate that. But if it's genuinely new money and if the independence of the CEFC is maintained, well, then I'll look at it in that light when I recommend a position to my colleagues when we see more detail. You know, I have said that publicly yesterday. Well, we'll have a look at it. And if it's new money, our objection has been the diversion of existing resources away from renewable energy. If this is genuinely new money, we'll look at it in that light. But, you know, it's all about the politics of Scott Morrison yesterday. All the backgrounding in The Australian was, you know, oh, this is a terrible wedge for Labor and, you know, the pressure's on Labor. No, mate, the pressure's on you because you're trying to play politics again. There was no commentary from Scott Morrison about how good this was for climate. It was all about how this is a wedge for Labor. I mean, this guy is ultimately still the state director of the Liberal Party. He's not the Prime Minister who brings the nation together. He's still the state director of the Liberal Party playing politics at every turn.
Cutting through that, it sounds as though you're pretty determined to dodge that wedge.
Well, I'll judge my recommendations to my colleagues based on the merits. If it's new money and the CEFC independence is protected, well, that'll reflect in my recommendation to my shadow cabinet colleagues. But, you know, as wedges go, as I said, they've wedged themselves.
Just finishing off on a couple of points about Labor more generally, branch stacking is a problem in Labor and in the Liberal Party, as we've seen in revelations recently. With fewer people wanting to join parties, how should they tackle this problem?
Well, I mean, I think all parties need to be vigilant. And in our case, I think the key difference is we support the role of the IBAC in Victoria and looking at us. Chris Minns, the leader in New South Wales, made the point recently that he supports ICAC not because they look at the Liberal Party, because they look at the Labor Party. I mean, we want to weed out these elements. And anybody who acts corruptly is not only betraying the community, they're betraying their party. You know, anybody in the Labor Party who turns corrupt is betraying our cause, and we want them out. And we support the role of ICACs in pursuing those matters, even if it might, you know, provide some uncomfortable television. We want them dealt with. That's the difference. The government, the Liberals, don't support ICACs. They don't want a federal ICAC. We do. Now, in relation to branch stacking, I think that all political parties have to be on a journey to think about how we return to being a more mass party. And, you know, we've engaged in reforms in our party to give members a say in the leadership, etc. That was all with a view to giving people a bigger say and encouraging people to join. And I think that's, you know, I think those things are important. The world has changed, though. Like now, you used to be, if you wanted to be politically active, you basically had to join a political party and go off to a branch meeting on a Monday night in a drafty hall. Now you can, you know, engage in Twitter and Facebook and change.org from the comfort of your nice warm lounge room. So, you know, the imperative to join a political party has changed, and I think political parties need to recognise that. And we have been in a process of recognising that and trying to give people more meaningful opportunities for engagement.
Just on that rule that gives branch members a say in the election of the leader, do you think that's worked? Are you happy with that? Some people say it would be better to go back to the caucus-only form of election for a variety of reasons.
Oh, look, I'm not proposing that. I think branch members do have a role in the most important decisions in our party, and the leadership is one of them.
As Labor makes itself a small target, some supporters and others wonder these days what it actually stands for. Just briefly, what does Labor stand for in 2021?
Well, we still stand for growth and opportunity, which is what I've always said Labor stands for. Economic growth lifts people out of poverty. It turns aspiration into reality. And we stand for giving people the opportunity to make the most of that. By that I do not mean a sort of narrow equality of opportunity frame. I mean the opportunity to live their lives to their fullest capacity. And only the Labor Party understands that and gets that. The Liberals don't get it. The Greens don't get the bringing together of the ring on those matters. We stand for, in my portfolio, we stand for strong action on climate. And again, I don't accept the premise of the question about small target. I mean, by the time we get the election, if you still think we're a small target on climate, well, by all means, express that view. But I think, to be fair, you've got to judge a political party over the term, and the term's not yet done, and we'll have plenty more to say about policies we'll take to the next election.
Chris Bowen, you're one of the busiest front benchers for Labor, but I noticed you've been keeping busy also as an author, recently publishing another book called Labor People, The Story of Six True Believers. What did you learn from these figures? Who are they indeed? And how do you find the time to write these books?
Well, you make time, Michelle. I make time. There's only so many briefing notes you can read on an aeroplane, and I don't really watch many movies, so that's time I spend. I find it relaxing to research and write, so I sort of sit on my lounge with my archives and my laptop, and that's how I enjoy unwinding sometimes. This is a book which has been floating around in my head for many years, actually. The history of the Labor Party, all political parties tend to be, but the Labor Party even more so, tends to be dominated by the big names, the big personalities, the big prime ministers. But of course, our history is richer than even that. And so I just wanted to take some names who've largely been forgotten in Australian Labor Party history and, if you like, not so much rehabilitate them because they've never been disgraced, but they've just sort of not had the place in history that I think they deserved. And really they're symbolic of the thousands of people in the Labor Party who played a big role. So just briefly, we start with the first deputy leader of the Labor Party. Not many people can answer the trivia question. Who was the first federal deputy leader of the Labor Party? The answer is the gloriously named Gregor McGregor, who was our leader in the Senate. And he was totally blind by the time he became leader of the Labor Party in the Senate in those early pioneering governments. He was a gardening labourer and he had a tree fall on his face early in his career and he'd gone blind. We have Lillian Locke, who was a great Labor suffragist. You know, Australia gave women the vote very early in an international context, and many people campaigned for that. But Lillian was the leading Labor campaigner for suffrage, and she had a remarkable story. And she actually later on in life becomes a remarkable figure in Australian literary history as well. I won't go into details. Hopefully people read the book to find out the connection between Lillian Locke and Australian literary history. Frank Tudor was the leader of the Labor Party at our darkest hour when Billy Hughes walked out on the caucus as Prime Minister, just got up out of his seat and walked out and left the Labor Party, and the party turned to Frank Tudor. And it was not guaranteed we'd survive that split. There was no guarantee that we would make it through that split. Frank Tudor played a big role in making sure the Labor Party, while we were down, we weren't out. John Dedman was Curtin and Chifley's right-hand man. You know, Curtin and Chifley were very big, of course, personalities and very big reformers, but they needed people to do a lot of the work, and John Dedman was who they always turned to for the toughest jobs in World War II and after World War II. And he was a great Labor man, although he did start life as a Country Party candidate. So that's an interesting journey. And then we have Gertrude Melville, who was the first Labor or the first woman elected to the upper house in New South Wales, which might sound a bit niche, but she had a remarkable story as well, loyal to the Labor Party through, 60 years of splits and divisions, and loyal to Chifley, and a remarkable woman. But she did stand up for causes she believed in, even if it upset the government she was a member of. And then Ken Reet, who was one of Whitlam's leaders in the Senate and the last leader in the Senate under Whitlam. He was a quiet achiever, a reformer. You'd remember him, Michelle. He was a reformer.
Yes, indeed.
He was Whitlam's agriculture minister, and he really shook up agricultural policy. But he was one of the few who could stand up to Whitlam. He would go in and tell Gough when he was wrong, which wasn't an easy thing to do. And they had some blazing rows. He thought Whitlam was mishandling the constitutional crisis. And when Whitlam was dismissed, Whitlam made the mistake of not telling Reet that they'd been dismissed as a government. Extraordinary when you think, there was no mobile phones, no Twitter, so word hadn't spread. And Reet, being uninformed by his prime minister, then let supply pass through the Senate, giving the new government of Malcolm Fraser supply without even knowing that Fraser was prime minister. And Reet never forgave Gough for that. That was an error. Well, would history have been very different? Well, I mean, I talk in the book about how history may or may not have been different, but clearly Reet should have been told. What did I learn? Well, really, I think the reason I like learning and writing about history is it reminds us that that nothing really changes. These people were engaged in massive battles. I find it inspiring. You look back and it all seems inevitable, but the battles that we're fighting today, they were fighting the same battles or bigger battles. And I draw inspiration from their tenacity. They kept going. They just kept fighting. They kept arguing. And it's a reminder that reform is a ever receding finishing line, and we have there's always more to do.
And I might add that in a coincidence, we are today recording on the anniversary of that dramatic day in 1975 when Whitlam didn't pass on the message to Ken Reet. Chris Bowen, thank you very much for talking with us today, and that's all for this Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.